Well, this morning then we're going to continue considering what Christmas is all about. Last week we suggested that it's about mystery, and this week we're going to suggest that Christmas is also about revelation. Now, I suppose that as Christians we perhaps don't often get all that excited by this word revelation in society at large. The word does seem to have a certain a significant appeal. Judging by the tabloid headlines each day, there's a pretty relentless demand for sensational new revelations, whether it's revelations of celebrities having affairs or revelations of leaked government documents or whatever it might be. But in the church, the word revelation is generally associated either with a rather complicated book at the end of the Bible or with the first few chapters in any volume of systematic theology. Well, this morning, we're talking about revelation more or less, I suppose, in the same sense in which you'd find it in the first few chapters of a systematic theology. We're talking about the truth, the reality that God has revealed himself to man. That's what we're talking about. But I want us to get away from any associations with kind of dusty, unreadable volumes of theology at the top of your bookshelves. And I want to insist rather that this reality of revelation, this truth of revelation in the sense I'm talking about God revealing himself to man, it's the most thrilling and wonderful and exciting theme you could contemplate. You see, in any sphere, revelation is what makes relationship possible, isn't it? So in a marriage, for instance, the wife discloses herself to her husband. She discloses her character. She discloses her temperament. She discloses her strengths and weaknesses, her hopes and ambitions, her fears and vulnerabilities. And of course, the husband, in the same way, discloses himself to his wife. And it's that disclosure, then, it's that revelation that makes the marriage work, isn't it? And it's the same to a lesser extent in any ordinary friendship. Friends disclose themselves to each other. They disclose to each other their characters and their interests and their preferences and their idiosyncrasies. And again, it's that disclosure, it's that revelation that makes the friendship work. And you see, it's because God has revealed himself to man. It's because God has disclosed himself to us that we can have a relationship with him. And if that's not exciting, if the idea of having an intimate relationship with the very creator of the universe isn't exciting, then I don't know what could possibly be exciting. So I'm saying that this theme of revelation is a thrilling one. And my whole argument, my whole point this morning is that nowhere does God reveal himself more than in the event, the phenomenon with which we associate Christmas. So I want to think about this morning under two headings, noticing first of all the revelation of God's personality. The revelation of God's personality. Now, there was a theological movement in the middle of the 20th century which set out to depersonalize God. Some of you may have heard of John A.T. Robinson. He was an Anglican bishop, and he was, I suppose, the most eminent representative of this movement. And these men then, they portrayed God as basically a kind of impersonal force, a kind of nebulous energy. They used phrases like the ground of being. That's what God is. He is the ground of being. And C.S. Lewis, I think, when he wrote his little book Beyond Personality, which was later incorporated as the fourth section in his famous work, Mere Christianity, He was very conscious of these ideas that were floating around. And in that little book, Beyond Personality, he argues most unequivocally that God is personal. He isn't an abstract force. He isn't a nebulous energy. He isn't the ground of being. No, God thinks, and God speaks, and God acts. God can meaningfully relate to and interact with other persons. God, Lewis said, is personal. And in fact, C.S. Lewis in that book, he went further than that. And he said that far from being less than personal, as these theologians were making out, God is in fact more than personal. He is more personal than anyone else. He is positively bursting with personality. What did he mean? Well, Lewis said, God is three personal. He isn't simply one solitary thinker and speaker and actor. He is a community of three thinkers and speakers and actors. It's not simply that God has the potential to relate to and interact with other persons. But within God's very being, there actually is relationship and interaction between persons going on all the time. There always has been. God is within himself this lively, dynamic fellowship of persons. That is his essential form. That is his essential shape. That is his essential structure, if you like. And so, as Lewis said, God is more than personal. He is hyper-personal. He is super-personal. And it's a very attractive picture, I think, that C.S. Lewis paints there of God. And it's very telling that while John A.T. Robinson's book, Honest to God, is barely read at all these days, C.S. Lewis's book, Mere Christianity, is devoured by Christians all over the world. It's a wonderfully attractive picture of God that he paints. But I want to ask the question, how do we know it's true? How do we know that God is this lively, dynamic fellowship of persons which C.S. Lewis outlined in that book? How do we know that the one true living God is more than one person? How do we know that? Do we know it from the Old Testament? Well, certainly in the Old Testament there are some very intriguing hints. There are some passages, for instance, where God refers to himself in a plural way. He refers to himself as us. So Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. God doesn't say, let me make man in my image. He says, let us make man in our image. Then there's Isaiah chapter 6, verse 8, where God is looking for someone whom he can commission as a prophet, as a spokesman. And remember, he doesn't say there, whom shall I send, who will go for me? He says, whom shall I send, and who will go for us? Or then there are those passages involving that rather mysterious character, the angel of the Lord. And very interestingly, in those passages, in the course of a single conversation, this person, the angel of the Lord, can both identify himself with God and also distinguish himself from God. And so, as I say, there are these intriguing little hints and suggestions, and there are more that I could mention. But they are only intriguing hints. And in and of themselves, they are not enough to lead anyone to the conclusion that God is more than one person. If all you had was the Old Testament, and you were to read the Old Testament again and again and again and again, from cover to cover, from Genesis to Malachi, for a million years, you would never suddenly exclaim, I've got it now. God is more than one person. You would, I'm sure, increasingly be perplexed and bemused by these passages I've just referred to. You would put them down as real enigmas, as real conundrums, but you would never conclude that God is more than one person simply from the Old Testament. So, can I come back to my question? How do we know that? How do we know that C.S. Lewis's God is indeed God? That is indeed what he looks like. Well, we know because about 2,000 years ago, someone turned up in this world of ours. And this person, his beginnings were really very unremarkable. Born as an ordinary little baby, indistinguishable from the rest of the world's population. In fact, you would even say that his background was rather underprivileged. He was laid in a manger, an animal's feeding trough at birth, and he was then raised as a child in the somewhat down-at-heel town of Nazareth. But then, as he grew, and as he matured, and as he developed, after a few years, things began to get interesting. As a 12-year-old, he was discovered one day by his mother and father in the temple in Jerusalem, debating with rabbis and scholars there. And upon being discovered and upon being interrogated by his parents, he responded, "Didn't you know I had to be in my father's house?" He was referring, in other words, to God as his father. 18 years later, he was baptized in the River Jordan. And on that occasion, a voice was heard from heaven, directly addressing this person and saying to him, "You are my son." That was then followed by 2 or 3 years in which this man traveled around Judea and Galilee and consistently referred to God as his father and consistently claimed to be the Son of God. The passage we read in John chapter 5 is full of such references and such claims. And you couldn't dismiss this man as some raving lunatic. You couldn't shrug him off as being a couple of sandwiches short of a picnic, because his claims were accompanied by the most wise and sane and perceptive and beautiful teaching the world has ever heard. And not only that, but his claims were attested by the most astonishing supernatural acts. And not only that, but supremely, his claims were vindicated when eventually he died, but didn't remain dead. 3 days later, he rose again. And so I'm saying that about 2,000 years ago, this world was visited by someone who claimed to be the Son of God, and his claims were eminently credible. Indeed, I think we can say they were thoroughly incontestable. And you see, the moment that you accept that, the moment that you accept that interpretation of what happened in Palestine 2 millennia ago, and as I say, I think it's the only possible interpretation, you are in the same moment accepting something else. You're accepting that God is more than one person. At the very least, he's two persons. He's a father and he's also a son. And you see, this is why when you read the New Testament epistles, you never come across an explicit statement of the doctrine of the Trinity. Perhaps some of you have been troubled by that in the past. When challenged on this doctrine, you've been troubled by the absence in the New Testament epistles of an explicit statement of this doctrine. But you see, if you were to say to one of the apostles, if you were to ask them, "Look, why didn't you give us an explicit statement of the doctrine of the Trinity?" If you were to ask Paul, "Why somewhere in the middle of Romans didn't you stop and say, 'Look, I'm going to map out for you in the clearest possible way this three personal manner in which the one true God exists.'" Or if you were to ask Peter or James or John a similar question, I would think they would answer you, "Well, why do you need an explicit statement of the doctrine of the Trinity? You've got the four Gospels and you've got the book of Acts. Now, what are the four Gospels about?" Well, they're about the mission of a divine person called the Son of God. And what's the book of Acts about? Well, it's about the mission of a divine person called the Holy Spirit. Well, there you have it. There you have the doctrine of the Trinity. You don't need anything else. Christmas, the incarnation, unmistakably reveals God to be more than one person, two persons at least, the Father and the Son. Pentecost reveals God to be, in fact, three persons, the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. And so I'm saying this morning, in my first point here, that Christmas shines this most astonishing light upon the very shape, if you like, of God himself. The very shape of God's eternal being. Let me put it this way. Bethlehem's manger exposes the fundamental difference between Christianity and Islam. You see, we could argue this morning, well, we could argue all day about the Quran and whether the Quran, in fact, legitimizes acts of violence and terrorism or whether it, in fact, promotes love and peace and harmony. We could go into all that. We could debate that at length. But whatever one's conclusions on that, the fact remains that if you probe Islam deeply enough, if you go deep enough into it, you will eventually come up against a kernel that is hard and unloving and dictatorial. Because the God of Islam is one solitary person. But you see, Bethlehem's manger is screaming out to us that at the very heart of Christianity, at the very heart, the very kernel, sorry, of Christianity, is love and cooperation and relationship. Because the God of Christianity is more than one person. He is that Father up in heaven, but he is also this Son come to earth, this little baby wrapped in swaddling clothes and surrounded by hungry animals and adoring shepherds. He is a Father and he is a Son. And Bethlehem's manger, therefore, is guaranteeing that the whole biblical emphasis on loving your neighbor and serving one another and looking out for the interests of others isn't superficial. It isn't skin deep. It isn't a sham. It isn't groundless. Because Bethlehem's manger is guaranteeing that that whole biblical emphasis is in fact rooted in the very being of God himself, in which there has always been loving one's neighbor, the Father loving the Son, and the Son loving the Father. There has always been mutual service, the Father serving the Son, and the Son serving the Father. There has always been looking out for one another's interests, the Father looking out for the interests of the Son, and the Son looking out for the interests of the Father. This whole biblical emphasis on love and on service and on putting others ahead of oneself, it's grounded in this God who eternally has been doing all of that between these persons, Father and Son. And so it's a vital light that Christmas is shining on God. It's demarcating the uniqueness of the Christian religion. And let's this morning then be prepared to pause in wonder and amazement at this revelation of Christmas, that God is personal, even to the extent of being more than one person. What a wonderful revelation. So the revelation of God's personality, but secondly this morning, the revelation of God's glory. Now, I suppose at first sight, the idea that the Son revealed God's glory seems eminently reasonable, doesn't it? We said last week that when the Son came to this earth, he did not for one moment relinquish his deity. He remained fully God. And so it seems to stand to reason then that if he remained fully God, then to some degree he would have revealed the glory of God. But then when you reflect on that for a moment longer, this thought strikes you. Hang on a minute. Yes, he remained fully God. But as we also said last week, he became fully man. And surely that humanity that he assumed, while not diminishing his divine glory, surely it did conceal and veil and hide his divine glory. Isn't that what Paul is saying in Philippians 2 when he talks about the Son being found in appearance as a man? In other words, as you walked past the Son of God in the streets of Nazareth or the streets of Capernaum or the streets of Jerusalem, as you brushed shoulders with him, you wouldn't have batted an eyelid. He wouldn't have turned your head for a single moment because he was found in appearance as a man. So surely then, that is saying that he wasn't really revealing God's glory when he was on earth. The glory was concealed by the humanity. Well, I'm very sympathetic with that idea. I think it's true. And I think it's a very important truth. I think it has vital discipleship implications, as Paul brings out there in Philippians 2. Namely, that if the Son of God himself was willing to obscure his glory and hide and conceal his glory, then who are we to go around strutting about the place and making a lot of ourselves and making out as though we are somebody when the great somebody himself was obscured by that very ordinary humanity? So I think it is true that the Son's divine glory was obscured, hidden, concealed behind his humanity. But I don't think that's the whole truth. I think we can go further than that. And I think we can say this, and let me warn you, this is going to sound crazy when you first hear it, but I'll explain it in a moment. I think we can say this, that it was in his very willingness to conceal his divine glory that supremely he revealed the glory of God. It was in his very willingness to conceal his divine glory that supremely he revealed the glory of God. You'll all be familiar with that great verse in John chapter 1 and verse 14. John, in verse 14 of chapter 1 of his gospel, he says that the Word, that is the Son of God, became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. So John is saying quite unambiguously, we have seen his glory. We've seen it. Me and my companions, the apostles, the disciples, we have seen his glory. But what did it mean for John to have seen his glory? What did it mean for John to have looked upon the glory of God in the person of Jesus Christ? Did it mean that to look at God's glory, did it mean to look at God's sheer omnipotence, his limitless power? Did it mean to look upon God's sheer omniscience, his limitless wisdom? Did it mean to look on God's sheer omnipresence, his unlimited presence, that he is everywhere? For John, was that what it meant to see the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ? Well, no, that can't be the answer, can it? Because John and his companions didn't really see all that much of those things. They didn't see much of his omnipotence. There wasn't much omnipotence in view on the night that the Son of God was arrested and taken off and flogged and crucified. They didn't see much of his omniscience. There wasn't much omniscience in view on the day that the Son of God said, I don't know the timing of the second coming. They didn't see much of his omnipresence. Never during his time with them was he in more than one place at one time. So when John says here, we have seen his glory, they're not talking about those kinds of things. They're not talking about omnipotence, omniscience, omnipresence, or those kinds of things. Well, what does John mean then? Well, he says, doesn't he, in that verse? He says, we have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. That word truth, I don't think it's the best translation in terms of our understanding. I think probably the word faithfulness is better translation. We have seen his glory full of grace and faithfulness. And so you see, John is saying, we have seen the glory of God in Jesus Christ. Not because we've seen loads of power and loads of wisdom and loads of majesty and all that kind of stuff. But we have seen the glory of God in Jesus Christ because we have seen in him sheer grace and sheer faithfulness. And you see, for John, God is most glorious in those two attributes. For John, the very highest manifestation of God's glory is his grace and his faithfulness. And that's no new idea. John wasn't being radical here. That has a pedigree as far back as the book of Exodus. Remember how in Exodus chapter 33, Moses says to God, show me your glory. I want to see your glory, O God. And so God does show him his glory. And this is how he does it in verse 6 of chapter 34 of Exodus. He passes in front of Moses, proclaiming, the Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness. Same two words, really, they're Hebrew equivalents. Love and faithfulness, grace and truth, grace and faithfulness. And so there you see right back in Exodus, Moses was saying, God, show me what your glory is. And God says, this is my glory, my love and my faithfulness. It's what we were singing earlier on this morning, wasn't it? But the fair glories of thy grace, more godlike and unrivaled shine. Yes, all your ways are matchless, godlike and divine. But it's your grace, it's your love, it's your loving kindness that transcends all your attributes. It, particularly, is the highest manifestation of your glory. And so John is saying then, that my companions and I, we have seen the glory of God in this person, Jesus Christ. Yes, even in this person who lived such an ordinary life to outward appearance. He ate like any other man does. He slept like any other man does. He wore clothes. He was tired. He looked like anybody else. He seemed to be so ordinary. And yet John can say, in him we have seen the glory of God. Because in him we have seen such unparalleled grace and faithfulness. And those are the highest manifestations of the glory of God. And so you see, we have a paradox here. That as the Son of God made that journey from Bethlehem to Golgotha, and as throughout that journey, he progressively hid his divine glory under more and more layers of ordinariness and marginalization and suffering. As he progressively hid his most obvious divine attributes, power and wisdom and majesty, he progressively hid the most obvious manifestations of his divine glory. In actually doing that, he was revealing the highest manifestations of divine glory. He was revealing the highest mountaintops of the glory of God because he was doing it out of grace to get alongside sinners and bear their sins on the cross. And he was doing it in the interests of faithfulness, keeping all the promises of the Old Testament to come and be the Savior of men and women. And I suppose this is brought out very neatly in that passage that we read earlier on, the foot washing in John chapter 13. Because it's fascinating there, isn't it? That we read in verses 2 and, well, we read in verse 3. This is John's introduction to this incident. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So he's saying, at this particular moment, Jesus was very aware of his divine identity. Very aware that he was from God and returning to God. Very aware of who he was at this moment. And then there's that wonderful linking word, so. So what does he do? At this moment, when he's most aware of who he is, that he is God, what does he do? Does he start kind of creating another universe or something? Does he start kind of delivering some magisterial words to the disciples? No, what does he do? He gets up from the meal, he takes off his outer clothing, he wraps a towel around his waist. He pours water into a basin, he begins to wash his disciples' feet. At the very moment he's most aware of who he is, this is what he does. He gets on the floor and wipes grubby disciples' feet. And it's saying the same thing, you see. That at this point when you would have said that his divine glory is most hidden, he doesn't look anything like God, surely, crawling around on that floor washing feet. Anything less godlike would be hard to find, surely. And yet at that moment, he is actually revealing as much as anywhere, or almost as much as anywhere, God's true nature, God's true heart, because he's doing it out of grace, and he's doing it out of faithfulness. And I suppose the foot washing itself only points us forward to something even greater, doesn't it? To Calvary, to the cross, where even more you would say, look, there's nothing less godlike imaginable than that battered, bruised, bloody figure, nailed like a piece of meat to a piece of wood. You couldn't imagine anything less godlike than that. Surely every last shred of divine glory is utterly hidden there. And yet, in actual fact, is it not there that more than anywhere you see the inmost heart of God? Because it's there that you see his grace and his faithfulness displayed in unmistakable, unambiguous terms. It's crying out, this God is from beginning to end gracious and faithful. And so this morning, how are you responding to the revelation of Christmas? To this astonishing revelation of God's grace and God's faithfulness? You see, there in John 13, you have that fascinating reaction of Peter, don't you? In verse 8, no, said Peter, you shall never wash my feet. Peter couldn't cope with it. Peter had some sense of how great Jesus was, and he couldn't cope with the idea of someone great crawling around on the floor, washing feet. It was utterly mind-boggling for Peter. His idea of a God was a God of austere majesty, a God who never smiles, a God who never departs from that austere and majestic appearance. That was his idea of God. And he couldn't cope with Jesus on the floor washing feet. And what's your idea of God this morning? Perhaps you have an idea of God a bit like Peter's, or some other random idea of God. Well, Christmas is saying, the manger at Bethlehem is saying, the foot washing is saying, the cross is saying, this is what God is like. God is more than anything gracious. God is more than anything faithful. This is the inmost heart of God. Come and believe in that God. Come and know that God as your Father. Come and worship that God. All other depictions of God are false and untrue. This is the true God. Come and bow before him. Have you done that this morning? Amen.